It is too much. Mouse had known she would reappear, but not that she would put him in a vice. And despite his speed, he has the feeling that he is traveling through a substance heavier and more viscous than air, a kind of syrup that slows him down, holds him back. Both he and the bike seem unnaturally dense, as if gravity exerts a stronger pull on the little road than anywhere else. His head pounds, and already he can hear that dog growling in the woods off to his right. He could take all of that, he supposes, if it were not for what stopped him the last time he drove up this path. A dead woman. Then she was Kiz Martin. Now the dead woman is little Nancy, and she is riding him like a dervish, slapping his head, punching him in the side, battering his ears. He feels her teeth leave his neck and sink into the left shoulder of his jacket. One of her arms whips in front of him, and he enters a deeper level of shock and horror when he realizes that this arm is visible. Rags of skin flutter over long bones. He glimpses white maggots wriggling into the few remaining knots of flesh. A hand that feels both sponge-like and bony flaps onto his cheek and crawls up his face. Mouse cannot keep it together anymore. His mind fills with white panic, and he loses control of the bike. When he heads into the curve that leads to Black House, the wheels are already tilting dangerously, and Mouse's sideways jerk of revulsion pushes them over beyond the possibility of correction. As the bike topples, he hears the dog snarling from only a few yards away. The Harley smashes down on his left leg, then skids ahead, and he and his ghastly passenger slide after it. When Mouse sees Black House looming from its dark bower amid the trees, a rotting hand flattens over his eyes. His scream is a bright, thin thread of sound against the fury of the dog. A few seconds after going in, Beezer feels the air thicken and congeal around him. It's some trick, he tells himself, an illusion produced by the fisherman's mind-fuck toxins. Trusting that the others will not be suckered by this illusion, he raises his head and looks over Mouse's broad back and corn-road head to see the road curve to the left about 50 feet ahead. The thick air seems to weigh down on his arms and shoulders, and he feels the onset of the mother and father of all headaches, a dull, insistent pain that begins as a sharp twinge behind his eyes and moves thudding deeper into his brain. Beezer gives Doc a half-second of attention, and from what he sees, Doc is taking care of business. A glance at the speedometer tells him that he is traveling at 35 miles per hour and gathering steam, so they should be doing 60 by the time they come into the curve. Off to his left, a dog growls. Beezer hauls his pistol out of his pocket and listens to the growling keep pace with them as they speed toward the curve. The band of pain in his head widens and intensifies. It seems to push at his eyes from the inside, making them bulge in their sockets. The big dog, it has to be a dog, what else could it be, is getting closer, and the fury of its noises makes Beezer see a giant tossing head with blazing red eyes and ropes of slather whipping from a gaping mouth filled with shark's teeth. Two separate things destroy his concentration. The first is that he sees Mouse slamming himself back and forth on his bike as he goes into the curve, as if he's trying to scratch his back on the thickening air. The second is that the pressure behind his eyes triples in force, and immediately after he sees Mouse going into what is surely a fall, the blood vessels in his eyes explode. From deep red, his vision shifts rapidly to absolute black. An ugly voice starts up in his head saying, Amy sat in my lap and hugged me. I made up my mind to eat her. How she dud-dud-dud kick and scratch. I choked her to death. No! Beezer shouts, and the voice that is pushing at his eyes drops into a rasping chuckle. For less than a second, he gets a vision of a tall, shadowy creature, and a single eye, a flash of teeth beneath a hat or a hood. And the world abruptly revolves around him, and he ends up flat on his back with the bike weighing on his chest. Everything he sees is stained a dark, seething red. Mouse is screaming, and when Beezer turns his head in the direction of the screams, he sees a red mouse lying on a red road with a huge red dog barreling toward him. Beezer cannot find his pistol. It went sailing into the woods. Shouts, screams, and the roar of motorcycles fill his ears. He scrambles out from under the bike, yelling he knows not what. A red doc flashes by on his red bike and almost knocks him down again. He hears a gunshot, then another. Doc sees Beezer glance at him and tries not to show how sick he feels. Dishwater boils in his stomach and his guts are writhing. It feels like he's going about 5 miles an hour. The air is so thick and rancid. For some reason, his head weighs 30 or 40 pounds. Damnedest thing. It would almost be interesting if he could stop the disaster happening inside him. The air seems to concentrate itself, to solidify, and then boom, his head turns into a super heavyweight bowling ball that wants to drop onto his chest. A giant growling sound comes from out of the woods beside him, and Doc almost yields to the impulse to puke. He is dimly aware that Beezer is pulling out his gun, and he supposes he should do the same. But part of his problem is that the memory of a child named Daisy Temperley has moved into his mind, and the memory of Daisy Temperley paralyzes his will. As a resident in surgery at the University Hospital in Urbana, Doc had performed under supervision nearly 100 operations of every sort and assisted at as many. Until Daisy Temperley was wheeled into the OR, all of them had gone well. Complicated, but not especially difficult or life-threatening, her case involved bone grafts and other repair work. Daisy was being put back together again after a serious auto accident, and she had already endured 2 previous surgeries. 2 hours after the start of the procedure, the head of the department, Doc's supervisor, was called away for an emergency operation, and Doc was left in charge. Partly because he had been sleep-deprived for 48 hours, partly because in his exhaustion he had pictured himself cruising along the highway with Beezer, Mouse, and his other new friends, he made a mistake. Not during the operation, but after it. While writing a prescription for medication, he miscalculated the dosage, and 2 hours later Daisy Temperley was dead. There were things he could have done to rescue his career, but he did none of them. He was allowed to finish his residency, and then he left medicine for good. Talking to Jack Sawyer, he had vastly simplified his motives. The uproar in the middle of his body can no longer be contained. Doc turns his head and vomits as he races forward. It is not the first time he has puked while riding, but it is the messiest and the most painful. The weight of his bowling ball head means that he cannot extend his neck, so vomit spatters against his right shoulder and right arm. And what comes leaping out of him feels alive and equipped with teeth and claws. He is not surprised to see blood mixed with the vomit erupting from his mouth. His stomach doubles in on itself with pain. Without meaning to, Doc has slowed down, and when he accelerates and faces forward again, he sees Mouse topple over sideways and skid behind his bike into the curve up ahead. His ears report a rushing sound, like that of a distant waterfall. Dimly, Mouse screams. Equally dimly, Beezer shouts, "No!" Right after that, the bees runs headlong into a big rock or some other obstruction because his electroglide leaves the ground, flips completely over in the compacted air, and comes down on top of him. It occurs to Doc that this mission is totally foobar. The whole world has hung a left, and now they are in deep shit. He does the only sensible thing. He yanks his trusty 9mm out of his pocket and tries to figure out what to shoot first. His ears pop, and the sounds around him surge into life. Mouse is still screeching. Doc cannot figure out how he missed hearing the noise of the dog before, because even with the roaring of the cycles and Mouse's screams, that moving growl is the loudest sound in the woods. The fucking Hound of the Baskervilles is racing toward them, and both Mouse and Beezer are out of commission. From the noise it makes, the thing must be the size of a bear. Doc aims the pistol straight ahead and steers with one hand as he blasts by Beezer, who is wriggling out from beneath his bike. That enormous sound, Doc imagines a bear-sized dog widening its chops around Mouse's head and instantly erases the image. Things are happening too fast, and if he doesn't pay attention, those jaws could close on him. He has just time enough to think, "That's no ordinary dog, not even a huge one," when something enormous and black comes charging out of the woods to his right and cuts on a diagonal toward Mouse. Doc pulls the trigger, and at the sound of the pistol, the animal whirls halfway around and snarls at him. All Doc can see clearly are two red eyes and an open red mouth with a long tongue and a lot of sharp canine teeth. Everything else is smudgy and indistinct, with no more definition than if it were covered in a swirling cape. A lightning bolt of pure terror that tastes as clean and sharp as cheap vodka pierces Doc from gullet to testicles, and his bike slews its rear end around and comes to a halt. He has stopped it out of sheer reflex. Suddenly it feels like deep night. Of course he can't see it. How could you see a black dog in the middle of the night? The creature whirls around again and streaks toward Mouse. "It doesn't want to charge me because of the gun and because the other two guys are right behind me," Doc thinks. His head and arms seem to have gained another 40 pounds apiece, but he fights against the weight of his muscles and straightens his arms and fires again. This time he knows he hits that thing, but its only reaction is to shudder off course for a moment. The big smudge of its head swings toward Doc. The growling gets even louder, and long, silvery streams of dog drool fly from its open mouth. Something that suggests a tail switches back and forth. When Doc looks into the open, red gash, his resolve weakens. His arms get heavier, and he is scarcely capable of holding his head upright. He feels as though he is falling down into that red maw. His pistol dangles from his limp hand. In a moment suspended throughout eternity, the same hand scribbles a post-op prescription for Daisy Temperley. The creature trots toward Mouse. Doc can hear Sonny's voice cursing furiously. A loud explosion on his right side seals both of his ears, and the world falls perfectly silent. "Here we are," Doc says to himself. "Darkness at noon." For Sonny, the darkness strikes at the same time as the searing pain in his head and his stomach. A single band of agony rips right down through his body, a phenomenon so unparalleled and extreme that he assumes it has also erased the daylight. He and Kaiser Bill are 8 feet behind Beezer and Doc and about 15 feet up the narrow dirt road. The Kaiser lets go of his handlebars and grips the sides of his head. Sonny understands exactly how he feels. A 4-foot section of red-hot iron pipe has been thrust through the top of his head and pushed down into his guts, burning everything it touches. "Hey, man," he says, in his misery noticing that the air has turned sludgy, as though individual atoms of oxygen and carbon dioxide are gummy enough to stick to his skin. Then Sonny notices that the Kaiser's eyes are swimming up toward the back of his head, and he realizes that the man is passing out right next to him. Sick as he is, he has to do something to protect the Kaiser. Sonny reaches out for the other man's bike, watching as well as he can the disappearance of the Kaiser's irises beneath his upper eyelids. Blood explodes out of his nostrils, and his body slumps backward on the seat and rolls over the side. For a couple of seconds, he is dragged along by a boot caught in the handlebars, but the boot slips off, and the cycle drifts to a halt. The red-hot iron bar seems to rupture his stomach, and Sonny has no choice. He lets the other bike fall and utters a groan and bends sideways and vomits out what feels like every meal he has ever eaten. When nothing is left inside him, his stomach feels better, but John Henry has decided to drive giant rail spikes through his skull. His arms and legs are made of rubber. Sonny focuses on his bike. It seems to be standing still. He does not understand how he can go forward, but he watches a blood-spattered hand gun his bike and manages to stay upright when it takes off. "Is that my blood?" he wonders, and remembers two long red flags unfurling from the Kaiser's nose. A noise that had been gathering strength in the background turns into the sound of a 747 coming in for a landing. Sonny thinks that the last thing he wants to do today is get a look at the animal capable of making that sound. Mouse was right on the money. This is a bad, bad place, right up there with the charming town of Harco, Illinois. Sonny wishes to encounter no more Harcos, okay? One was enough. So why is he moving forward instead of turning around and running for the sunny piece of Highway 35? Why is he pulling that massive gun out of his pocket? It's simple. He is not about to let that jet airplane dog mess up his homies, no matter how much his head hurts. John Henry keeps pounding in those $5 spikes while Sonny picks up speed and squints at the road ahead, trying to figure out what is going on. Someone screams. He cannot identify who. Through the growling, he hears the unmistakable sound of a motorcycle hitting the ground after a flip, and his heart shivers. Beezer should always be point man, he thinks, otherwise we're asking for punishment. A gun goes off with a loud explosion. Sonny forces himself to press through the gluey atoms in the air, and after another 5 or 6 seconds he spots Beezer, who is painfully pushing himself upward beside his toppled bike. A few feet beyond Beezer, Doc's bulky figure comes into view, sitting astride his bike and aiming his 9 at something in the road ahead of him. Doc fires, and red flame bursts from the barrel of his pistol. Feeling more beat up and useless than ever before in his life, Sonny jumps from his moving bike and runs toward Doc, trying to look past him. The first thing he sees is a flash of light off Mouse's bike, which comes into view flat on its side about 20 feet down the road at the top of the curve. Then he finds Mouse on his ass and scrambling backward from some animal Sonny can barely make out, except for its eyes and teeth. Unconscious of the stream of obscenities that pour from his mouth, Sonny levels his pistol at the creature and fires just as he runs past Doc. Doc just stands there. Doc is out for the count. The weird animal up on the road closes its jaws on Mouse's leg. It is going to rip away a hamburger-sized chunk of muscle, but Sonny hits it with a fucking hollow-point missile from his Magnum. A bit show-offy for target practice, but under the circumstances, no more than prudent, thank you very much. Contrary to all expectations and the laws of physics, Sonny's amazing Wonder Bullet does not knock a hole the size of a football in the creature's hide. The Wonder Bullet pushes the animal sideways and distracts it from Mouse's leg. It does not even knock it down. Mouse sends up a howl of pain. The dog whips around and glares at Sonny with red eyes the size of baseballs. Its mouth opens on jagged white teeth, and it snaps the air. Ropes of slime shoot out of its jaws. The creature lowers its shoulders and steps forward. Amazingly, its snarling grows in volume and ferocity. Sonny is being warned. If he does not turn and run, he is next on the menu. Fuck that, Sonny says, and fires straight at the animal's mouth. Its whole head should fly apart in bloody rags. But for a second after the Magnum goes off, nothing changes. Oh, shit, Sonny thinks. The dog thing's eyes blaze, and its feral, wedge-shaped head seems to assemble itself out of the darkness in the air and emerge into view. As though an inky robe had been partially twitched aside, Sonny can see a thick neck descending to meaty shoulders and strong front legs. Maybe the tide is turning here. Maybe this monster will turn out to be vulnerable after all. Sonny braces his right wrist with his left hand, aims at the dog thing's chest, and squeezes off another round. The explosion seems to stuff his ears with cotton. All the railroad spikes in his head heat up like electric coils, and bright pain sings between his temples. Dark blood gouts from the creature's brisket. At the center of Sonny Cantanaro's being, a pure, primitive triumph bursts into life. More of the monster melts into visibility, the wide back and a suggestion of its rear legs. Of no recognizable breed and 4.5 feet high, the dog thing is approximately the size of a gigantic wolf. When it moves toward him, Sonny fires again. Like an echo, the sound of his gun repeats from somewhere close behind. A bullet like a supercharged wasp zings past his chest. The creature staggers back, limping on an injured leg. Its enraged eyes bore into Sonny's. He risks glancing over his shoulder and sees Beezer braced in the middle of the narrow road. "Don't look at me! Shoot!" Beezer yells. His voice seems to awaken Doc, who raises his arm and takes aim. Then all three of them are pulling their triggers, and the little road sounds like the firing range on a busy day. The dog thing, Hellhound, Sonny thinks, limps back a step and opens wide its terrible mouth to howl in rage and frustration. Before the howl ends, the creature gathers its rear legs beneath its body, springs across the road, and vanishes into the woods. Sonny fights off the impulse to collapse under a wave of relief and fatigue. Doc swivels his body and keeps firing into the darkness behind the trees until Beezer puts a hand on his arm and orders him to stop. The air stinks of cordite and some animal odor that is musky and disgustingly sweet. Pale gray smoke shimmers almost white as it filters upward through the darker air. Beezer's haggard face turns to Sonny, and the whites of his eyes are crimson. "You hit that fucking animal, didn't you?" Through the wads of cotton in his ears, Beezer's voice sounds small and tinny. "Shit, yes! At least twice, probably three times. And Doc and I hit it once apiece. What the hell is that thing?" "What the hell is right?" Sonny says. Weeping with pain, Mouse, a third time, repeats his cry of, "Help me!" And the others hear him at last. Moving slowly and pressing their hands over whatever parts of their bodies hurt the most, they hobble up the road and kneel in front of Mouse. The right leg of his jeans is ripped and soaked with blood, and his face is contorted. "Are you assholes deaf?" "Pretty near," Doc says. "Tell me you didn't take a bullet in your leg." "No, but it must be some kind of miracle." He winces and inhales sharply. Air hisses between his teeth. "Way you guys are shooting. Too bad you couldn't draw a bead before it bit my leg."
"I did," Sonny says. "Reason you still got a leg."
Mouse peers at him, then shakes his head.
"What happened to the Kaiser?"
"He lost about a liter of blood through his nose and passed out," Sonny tells him.
Mouse sighs as if at the frailty of the human species.
"I believe we might try to get out of this crazy shithole."
"Is your leg all right?" Beezer asks.
"It's not broken, if that's what you mean, but it's not all right either."
"What?" Doc asks.
"I can't say," Mouse tells him. "I don't answer medical questions from guys all covered in puke."
"Can you ride?"
"Fuck yes, Beezer. You ever know me when I couldn't ride?"
Beezer and Sonny each take a side, and with excruciating effort lift Mouse to his feet. When they release his arms, Mouse lumbers sideways a few steps.
"This is not right," he says.
"That's brilliant," says Beezer.
"Beez, old buddy, you know your eyes are like bright red. You look like fucking Dracula."
To the extent that hurry is possible, they are hurrying. Doc wants to get a look at Mouse's leg. Beezer wants to make sure that Kaiser Bill is still alive. And all of them want to get out of this place and back into normal air and sunlight. Their heads pound and their muscles ache from strain. None of them can be sure that the dog thing is not preparing for another charge. As they speak, Sonny has been picking up Mouse's fat boy and rolling it toward its owner. Mouse takes the handles and pushes his machine forward, wincing as he goes. Beezer and Doc rescue their bikes, and 6 feet along, Sonny pulls his upright out of a snarl of weeds. Beezer realizes that when he was at the curve in the road, he failed to look for Black House. He remembers Mouse saying, "This shit doesn't want to be seen," and he thinks Mouse got it just about right. The fisherman did not want them there, and the fisherman did not want his house to be seen. Everything else was spinning around in his head, the way his electroglide had spun over after that ugly voice spoke up in his mind. Beezer was certain of one thing, however. Jack Sawyer was not going to hold out on him any longer. Then a terrible thought struck him, and he asked,
"Did anything funny, anything really strange happened to you guys before the dog from hell jumped out of the woods? Besides the physical stuff, I mean."
He looks at Doc, and Doc blushes.
Hello, Beezer thinks. Mouse says, go fuck yourself, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm with Mouse, Sonny says. I guess the answer is yes, Beezer says. Kaiser Bill is lying by the side of the road with his eyes closed and the front of his body wet with blood from mouth to waist. The air is still gray and sticky. Their bodies seem to weigh 1,000 pounds, the bikes to roll on leaden wheels. Sonny walks his bike up beside the Kaiser's supine body and kicks him, not all that gently, in the ribs. The Kaiser opens his eyes and groans. Fuck, Sonny, he says. You kicked me. His eyelids flutter and he lifts his head off the ground and notices the blood soaking into his clothing. What happened? Am I shot? You conducted yourself like a hero, Sonny says. How do you feel?
Lousy. Where was I hit?
How am I supposed to know, Sonny says. Come on, we're getting out of here. The others file past. Kaiser Bill manages to get to his feet, and after another epic struggle, hauls his bike upright beside him. He pushes it down the track after the others, marveling at the pain in his head and the quantity of blood on his body. When he comes out through the last of the trees and joins his friends on Highway 35, the sudden brightness stabs his eyes. His body feels light enough to float away, and he nearly passes out all over again.
I don't think I did get shot, he says.
No one pays any attention to the Kaiser. Doc is asking Mouse if he wants to go to the hospital.
No hospital, man. Hospitals kill people.
At least let me take a look at your leg.
Fine, look.
Doc kneels at the side of the road and tugs the cuff of Mouse's jeans up to the bottom of his knee. He probes with surprisingly delicate fingers, and Mouse winces. Mouse, he says, I've never seen a dog bite like this before.
Never saw a dog like that before either.
The Kaiser says,
what dog?
There's something funny about this wound, Doc says. You need antibiotics, and you need them right away.
Don't you have antibiotics?
Sure I do.
Then let's go back to Beezer's place and you can stick me full of needles.
Whatever you say, says Doc. Chapter 20. Around the time Mouse and Beezer first failed to see the little road and the no trespassing sign beside it, Jack Sawyer answers the annoying signal of his cell phone, hoping that his caller will turn out to be Henry Layden with information about the voice on the 911 tape. Although an identification would be wonderful, he does not expect Henry to ID the voice. The fisherman Burnside is Potsy's age, and Jack does not suppose the old villain has much of a social life, here or in the territories. What Henry can do, however, is to apply his finely tuned ears to the nuances of Burnside's voice and describe what he hears in it. If we did not know that Jack's faith in his friend's capacity to hear distinctions and patterns inaudible to other people was justified, that faith would seem as irrational as the belief in magic. Jack trusts that a refreshed, invigorated Henry Layden will pick up at least one or two crucial details of history or character that will narrow the search. Anything that Henry picks up will interest Jack. If someone else is calling him, he intends to get rid of whoever it is fast. The voice that answers his greeting revises his plans. Fred Marshall wants to talk to him, and Fred is so wound up and incoherent that Jack must ask him to slow down and start over.
Judy's flipping out again, Fred says, just babbling and raving and getting crazy like before, trying to rip through the walls. Oh, God, they put her in restraints, and she hates that. She wants to help Ty. It's all because of that tape. Christ, it's getting to be too much to handle, Jack, Mr. Sawyer. I mean it, and I know I'm running off at the mouth, but I'm really worried.
Don't tell me someone sent her the 911 tape, Jack says.
No, not... What 911 tape? I'm talking about the one that was delivered to the hospital today, addressed to Judy. Can you believe they let her listen to that thing? I want to strangle Dr. Spiegelman and that nurse, Jane Bond. What's the matter with these people? The tape comes in, they say, oh, goody, here's a nice tape for you to listen to, Mrs. Marshall. Hold on, I'll be right back with a cassette player. On a mental ward? They don't even bother to listen to it first?
Look, whatever you're doing, I'd be eternally grateful if you'd let me pick you up so I could drive you over there. You could talk to her. You're the only person who can calm her down.
You don't have to pick me up because I'm already on the way. What was on the tape?
I don't get it. Fred Marshall has become considerably more lucid. Why are you going there without me?
After a second of thought, Jack tells him an outright lie. I thought you would probably be there already. It's a pity you weren't.
I would have had the sense to screen that tape before letting her hear it. Do you know what was on that thing?
The fisherman, Jack says.
How did you know?
He's a great communicator, Jack says. How bad was it?
You tell me and then we'll both know. I'm piecing it together from what I gathered from Judy and what Dr. Spiegelman told me later.
Fred Marshall's voice begins to waver.
The fisherman was taunting her. Can you believe that? He said, your little boy is very lonely. Then he said something like he's been begging and begging to call home and say hello to his mommy. Except Judy says he has a weird foreign accent or a speech impediment or something, so he wasn't easy to understand right away. Then he says, say hello to your mommy, Tyler. And Tyler...
Fred's voice breaks, and Jack can hear him stifling his agony before he begins again.
Tyler was apparently too distressed to do much but scream for help.
A long, uncertain inhalation comes over the phone.
And he cried, Jack, he cried.
Unable to contain his feelings any longer, Fred weeps openly, unguardedly. His breath rattles in his throat. Jack listens to all the wet, undignified, helpless noises people make when grief and sorrow cancel every other feeling, and his heart moves for Fred Marshall. The sobbing relents.
Sorry. Sometimes I think they'll have to put me in restraints.
Was that the end of the tape?
He got on again.
Fred breathes noisily for a moment, clearing his head,
boasting about what he was going to do. There will be more murders and more after that, Judy. We are all going to have such fun. Spiegelman quoted this junk to me. The children of French Landing will be harvested like wheat, harvested like wheat. Who talks like that? What kind of person is this?
I wish I knew, Jack says. Maybe he was putting on an accent to sound even scarier, or to disguise his voice. He'd never disguise his voice, Jack thinks. He's too delighted with himself to hide behind an accent. I'll have to get the tape from the hospital and listen to it myself, and I'll call you as soon as I have some information.
There's one more thing, Marshall says. I probably made a mistake. Wendell Green came over about an hour ago.
Anything involving Wendell Green is automatically a mistake. So what happened?
It was like he knew all about Tyler and just needed me to confirm it. I thought he must have heard from Dale or the state troopers, but Dale hasn't made us public yet, has he?
Wendell has a network of little weasels that feed him information. If he knows anything, that's how he heard about it. What did you tell him?
More or less everything, Marshall says, including the tape. Oh, God, I'm such a dope. But I thought it'd be all right. I thought it would all get out anyhow.
Fred, did you tell him anything about me?
Only that Judy trusts you and that we're both grateful for your help, and I think I said that you would probably be going in to see her this afternoon.
Did you mention Ty's baseball cap?
Do you think I'm nuts? As far as I'm concerned, that stuff is between you and Judy. If I don't get it, I'm not going to talk about it to Wendell Green. At least I got him to promise to stay away from Judy. He has a great reputation, but I got the feeling he isn't everything he's cracked up to be.
You said a mouthful, Jack says. I'll be in touch. When Fred Marshall hangs up, Jack punches in Henry's number.
I may be a little late, Henry. I'm on my way to French County Lutheran. Judy Marshall got a tape from the fisherman, and if they'll let me have it, I'll bring it over. There's something strange going on here. On Judy's tape, I guess he has some kind of foreign accent.
Henry tells Jack there is no rush. He has not listened to the first tape yet, and now will wait until Jack comes over with the second one. He might hear something useful if he plays them in sequence. At least he could tell Jack if they were made by the same man.
And don't worry about me, Jack. In a little while, Mrs. Morton is coming by to take me over to KDCU. George Rathbun butters my bread today, baby. 6 or 7 radio ads.
Even a blind man knows you want to treat your honey, your sweetheart, your lovey-dovey, your wife, your best friend, through thick and thin, to fine dinner tonight. And there's no place better to show your appreciation to the old ball and chain than to take her to Cousin Buddy's Rib Crib on South Wabash Street in beautiful downtown La Riviere.
The old ball and chain? You pay for George Rathbun, you get George Rathbun, warts and all. Laughing, Jack tells Henry he will see him later that day and pushes the ram up to 70. What is Dale going to do, give him a speeding ticket? He parks in front of the hospital instead of driving around to the parking lot and trots across the concrete with his mind filled with the territories and Judy Marshall. Things are hurtling forward, picking up pace, and Jack has the sense that everything converges on Judy. No, on Judy and him. The fisherman has chosen them more purposefully than he did his first three victims. Amy St. Pierre, Johnny Erkenham, and Irma Freneau were simply the right age. Any three children would have done. But Tyler was Judy Marshall's son, and that set him apart. Judy has glimpsed the territories. Jack has traveled through them, and the fisherman lives there the way a cancer cell lives in a healthy organism. The fisherman sent Judy a tape, Jack a grisly present. At Tansy Freneau's, he had seen Judy as his key and the door it opened, and where did that door lead but into Judy's faraway? Faraway. God, that's pretty. Beautiful, in fact. Ah, the word evokes Judy Marshall's face. And when he sees that face, a door in his mind, a door that is his and his alone, flies open. And for a moment, Jack Sawyer stops moving altogether, and in shock, dread, and joyous expectation, freezes on the concrete 6 feet from the hospital's entrance. Through the door in his mind pours a stream of disconnected images. A stalled Ferris wheel, Santa Monica cops milling behind a strip of yellow crime scene tape, light reflected off a black man's bald head. Yes, a bald man's black head, that which he really and truly, in fact, most desperately, had not wished to see. So take a good look, kiddo, here it is again. There had been a guitar, but the guitar was elsewhere. The guitar belonged to the magnificent, demanding, comforting, comfortless Speedy Parker. God bless him, God damn his eyes, God love him, Speedy, who touched its strings and sang, "Travelin' Jack, oh, travelin' Jack, got a far long way to go, longer way to come back." Worlds spin around him, worlds within worlds, and other worlds alongside them, separated by a thin membrane composed of 1,000,000 doors, if only you know how to find them. 1,000,000 red feathers, tiny ones, feathers from a robin redbreast. Hundreds of robin redbreasts flew through one of those doors. Speedies. Robin. As in Robin's Egg Blue, "Thank You, Speedy," and a song that said, wake up, you sleepyhead. Or, wake up, you dunderhead. Crazily, Jack hears George Rathbun's now not-so-genial roar. "Even a blind man could have seen this one coming, you knothead!" "Oh, yeah?" Jack says out loud. It is a good thing head nurse Jane Bond, Warden Bond, Agent 00, cannot hear him. She's tough, but on the other hand, she's unfair. And if she were to appear beside him now, she would probably clap him in irons, sedate him, and drag him back to her domain. "Well, I know something you don't know, old buddy. Judy Marshall has a twinner. And the twinner has been whispering through the wall for a considerable old time now. It's no surprise she finally started to shout." A red-haired teenager in an Arden HS baseball t-shirt shoves open the literal door 6 feet from Jack and gives him a wary, disconcerted look. "Man, grown-ups are weird," the look says. "Aren't I glad I'm a kid?" Since he is a high school student and not a mental health professional, he does not clap our hero in irons and drag him sedated away to the padded room. He simply takes care to steer a wide course around the madman and keeps walking, albeit with a touch of self-conscious stiffness in his gait. It is all about Twinners, of course. Rebuking his stupidity, Jack raps his knuckles against the side of his head. He should have seen it before. He should have understood immediately. If he has any excuse, it is that at first he refused to think about the case despite Speedy's efforts to wake him up, then became so caught up in concentrating on the fisherman that until this morning, while watching his mother on the sandbar's big TV, he had neglected to consider the monster's twinner. In Judy Marshall's childhood, her twinner had spoken to her through that membrane between the two worlds. Growing more and more alarmed over the past month, the twinner had all but thrust her arms through the membrane and shaken Judy senseless. Because Jack is single-natured and has no twinner, the corresponding task fell to Speedy. Now that everything seems to make sense, Jack cannot believe it has taken him so long to see the pattern. And this is why he has resented everything that kept him from standing before Judy Marshall. Judy is the doorway to her twinner, to Tyler, and to the destruction of both the fisherman and his opposite number in the territories, the builder of the satanic, fiery structure a crow named Gorg showed Tansy Freneau. Whatever happens on Ward D today, it is going to be world-altering. Heart thrumming in anticipation, Jack passes from intense sunlight into the vast ochre space of the lobby. The same bath-robed patients seem to occupy the many chairs. In a distant corner, the same doctors discuss a troublesome case, or, who knows, that tricky tenth hole at Arden Country Club. The same golden lilies raise their luxuriant, attentive heads outside the gift shop. This repetition reassures Jack. It hastens his step, for it surrounds and cushions the unforeseeable events awaiting him on the fifth floor. The same board clerk responds to the proffer of the same password with an identical, if not the same, green card stamped visitor. The elevator, surprisingly similar to one in the Ritz Hotel on the Place Vendôme, obediently trembles upward past floors 2, 3, and 4, in its dowager-like progress, pausing to admit a gaunt young doctor who summons the memory of Roderick Usher, then releases Jack on 5, where the beautiful ochre light seems a shade or two darker than down there in the huge lobby. From the elevator, Jack retraces the steps he took with his guide, Fred Marshall, down the corridor, through the 2 sets of double doors and past the way stations of gerontology and ambulatory ophthalmology and records annex, getting closer and closer to the unforeseen, unforeseeable, as the corridors grow narrower and darker, and emerges, as before, into the century-old room with high, skinny windows and a lot of walnut-colored wood. And there the spell breaks, for the attendant seated behind the polished counter, the person currently the guardian of this realm, is taller, younger, and considerably more sullen than his counterpart of the day before. When Jack asks to see Mrs. Marshall, the young person glances in disdain at his visitor card and inquires if he should happen to be a relative or, another glance at the card, a medical professional. Neither, Jack admits, but if the young person could trouble himself to inform Nurse Bond that Mr. Sawyer wishes to speak to Mrs. Marshall, Nurse Bond is practically guaranteed to swing open the forbidding metal doors and wave him inward, since that is more or less what she did yesterday. That is all well and good if it happens to be true, the young person allows, but Nurse Bond is not going to be doing any door opening and waving in today, for today Nurse Bond is off duty. Could it be that when Mr. Sawyer showed up to see Mrs. Marshall yesterday, he was accompanied by a family member, say, Mr. Marshall? Yes. And if Mr. Marshall were to be consulted, say, via the telephone, he would urge the young fellow presently discussing the matter in a commendably responsible fashion with Mr. Sawyer to admit the gentleman promptly. That may be the case, the young person grants, but hospital regulations require that non-medical personnel in positions such as the young person's obtain authorization for any outside telephone calls. And from whom, Jack wishes to know, would this authorization be obtained? From the acting head nurse, Nurse Rack. Jack, who is growing a little hot, as they say, under the collar, suggests in that case that the young person seek out the excellent Nurse Rack and obtain the required authorization so that things might progress in the manner Mr. Marshall, the patient's husband, would wish. No, the young person sees no reason to pursue such a course, the reason being that doing so would represent a pitiful waste of time and effort. Mr. Sawyer is not a member of Mrs. Marshall's family. Therefore, the excellent Nurse Rack would under no circumstances grant the authorization. Okay, Jack says, wishing he could strangle this irritating pipsqueak. Let's move a step up the administrative ladder, shall we? Is Dr. Spiegelman somewhere on the premises? Could be, the young person says. How am I supposed to know? Dr. Spiegelman doesn't tell me everything he does. Jack points to the telephone at the end of the counter. I don't expect you to know. I expect you to find out. Get on that phone now. The young man slouches down the counter to the telephone, rolls his eyes, punches two numbered keys, and leans against the counter with his back to the room. Jack hears him muttering about Spiegelman, sigh, then say, "All right, transfer me, whatever." Transferred, he mutters something that includes Jack's name. Whatever he hears in response causes him to jerk himself upright and sneak a wide-eyed look over his shoulder at Jack. "Yes, sir. He's here now, yes. I'll tell him." He replaces the receiver. "Dr. Spiegelman'll be here right away." The boy, he is no more than 20, steps back and shoves his hands in his pockets. "You're that cop, huh?" "What cop?" Jack says, still irritated. "The one from California that came here and arrested Mr. Kinderling?" "Yes, that's me." "I'm from French Landing, and boy, that was some shock. To the whole town. Nobody would have guessed. Mr. Kinderling? Are you kidding? You'd never believe that someone like that would, you know, kill people." "Did you know him?" "Well, in a town like French Landing, everybody sort of knows everybody, but I didn't really know Mr. Kinderling except to say hi. The one I knew was his wife. She used to be my Sunday school teacher at Mount Hebron Lutheran." Jack cannot help it. He laughs at the incongruity of the murderer's wife teaching Sunday school classes. The memory of Wanda Kinderling radiating hatred at him during her husband's sentencing stops his laughter, but it is too late. He sees that he has offended the young man. "What was she like?" he asks, "as a teacher?" "Just a teacher," the boy says. His voice is uninflected, resentful. "She made us memorize all the books of the Bible." He turns away and mutters, "Some people think he didn't do it." "What did you say?" The boy half turns toward Jack, but looks at the brown wall in front of him. "I said, some people think he didn't do it, Mr. Kinderling. They think he got put in jail because he was a small-town guy who didn't know anybody out there." "That's too bad," Jack says. "Do you want to know the real reason Mr. Kinderling went to prison?" The boy turns the rest of the way and looks at Jack. "Because he was guilty of murder and he confessed. That's it. That's all. Two witnesses put him at the scene, and two other people saw him on a plane to L.A. when he told everyone he was flying to Denver. After that, he said, 'Okay, I did it. I always wanted to know what it was like to kill a girl, and one day I couldn't stand it anymore, so I went out and killed one.' His lawyer tried to get him off on an insanity plea, but the jury at his hearing found him sane, and he went to prison." The boy lowers his head and mumbles something. "I couldn't hear that," Jack says. "Lots of ways to make a guy confess." The boy repeats the sentence just loud enough to be heard. Then footsteps ring in the hallway, and a plump, white-coated man with steel-rimmed glasses and a goatee comes striding toward Jack with his hand out. The boy has turned away. The opportunity to convince the attendant that he did not beat a confession out of Thornburg Kinderling has slipped away. The smiling man with the white jacket and the goatee seizes Jack's hand, introduces himself as Dr. Spiegelman, and declares it a pleasure to meet such a famous personage. Personage persiflage, Jack thinks. From one step behind the doctor, a man unnoticed until this moment steps fully into view and says, "Hey, doctor!
Do you know what would be perfect? If Mr. Famous and I interview the lady together. Twice the information in half the time. Perfect.
Jack's stomach turned sour. Wendell Green has joined the party. After greeting the doctor, Jack turns to the other man.
What are you doing here, Wendell? You promised Fred Marshall you'd stay away from his wife.
Wendell Green holds up his hands and dances back on the balls of his feet.
Are we calmer today, Lieutenant Sawyer? Not inclined to use a sucker punch on the hard-working press, are we? I have to say I'm getting a little tired of being assaulted by the police.
Dr. Spiegelman frowns at him.
What are you saying, Mr. Green? Yesterday, before that cop knocked me out with his flashlight, Lieutenant Sawyer here punched me in the stomach for no real reason at all. It's a good thing I'm a reasonable man or I'd have filed lawsuits already. But, Doctor, you know what? I don't do things that way. I believe everything works out better if we cooperate with each other.
Halfway through this self-serving speech, Jack thinks, oh, hell, and glances at the young attendant. The boy's eyes burn with loathing. A lost cause. Now Jack will never persuade the boy that he did not mistreat Kinderling. By the time Wendell Green finishes congratulating himself, Jack has had a bellyful of his specious, smarmy affability.
Mr. Green offered to give me a percentage of his take if I let him sell photographs of Irma Freneau's corpse, he tells the doctor.
What he is asking now is equally unthinkable. Mr. Marshall urged me to come here and see his wife, and he made Mr. Green promise not to come.
Technically, that may be true, Green says. As an experienced journalist, I know that people often say things they don't mean and will eventually regret. Fred Marshall understands that his wife's story is going to come out sooner or later.
Does he?
Especially in the light of the fisherman's latest communication, Green says.
This tape proves that Tyler Marshall is his fourth victim and that miraculously he is still alive. How long do you think that can be kept from the public? And wouldn't you agree that the boy's mother should be able to explain the situation in her own words?
I refuse to be badgered like this.
The doctor scowls at Green and gives Jack a look of warning.
Mr. Green, I am very close to ordering you out of this hospital. I wish to discuss several matters with Lieutenant Sawyer in private. If you and the lieutenant can work out some agreement between the two of you, that is your affair. I am certainly not going to permit a joint interview with my patient. I am in no way certain that she should talk to Lieutenant Sawyer either. She is calmer than she was this morning, but she is still fragile.
The best way to deal with her problem is to let her express herself, Green says.
You will be quiet now, Mr. Green, Dr. Spiegelman says.
The double chins that fold under his goatee turn a warm pink. He glares at Jack.
What specifically is it that you request, Lieutenant?
Do you have an office in this hospital, Doctor?
I do.
Ideally, I'd like to spend about half an hour, maybe less, talking to Mrs. Marshall in a safe, quiet environment where our conversation would be completely confidential. Your office would probably be perfect. There are too many people on the ward, and you can't talk without being interrupted or having other patients listen in.
My office, Spiegelman says.
If you're willing.